Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Pollination is the most important thing that bees do for people. We all enjoy the honey, but pollination is so vital to our agriculture today.
That's Tracy Hunter of Hunter's Honey Farm. Gretchen Frazee speaks with him and researchers from Indiana University to find out what makes a bee colony strong and healthy. Also in the program, volunteers at the Bloomington Community Orchard build beehives and birdhouses to entice pollinators to call the orchard home. And in the kitchen, we celebrate an all-vegan Cinco de Mayo. But first, here's Mia Partlow with a look at the latest in food news headlines. Good to see you, Mia.
Hello. Progress was made on the 2012 Farm Bill last week when the Senate Agriculture Committee passed their version, a five-year, half-trillion-dollar bill. The Agriculture Reform, Food, and Jobs Act of 2012 promises to reduce the federal deficit by $23 billion by eliminating subsidies, consolidating programs, and improving SNAP accountability. The Senate committee's bill follows almost exactly a week after the passage of a different bill in the House. Perhaps the most noteworthy line on the bill is the elimination of subsidies. They cost $5 billion annually and are increasingly viewed as unnecessary, as net farm income reached an all-time high of $98.1 billion in 2011 and is projected to reach $91.7 billion, its second highest level, in 2012. Subsidies will be replaced by an insurance-like system, which is designed to supplement the federal crop insurance program. Support and opposition to the Senate bill have come from widespread political and geographic sources. Senate Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow from Michigan and ranking Senate Republican Pat Roberts from Kansas have both voiced confidence in the bill. But Southern lawmakers say that the new bill fails to provide enough protection for Southern crops like peanuts and rice, which have higher input costs, greater restrictions on crop insurance, and tend to be grown in volatile weather regions. And a story from your local grocery store, Kashi has decided to go non-GMO in their cereals and granola bars. If you're surprised to hear that there are GMOs in a product that calls itself all-natural, you're not alone. A Rhode Island grocer decided to stop carrying Kashi cereals after reading a report stating it contained some genetically modified and non-organic ingredients. Port Smith's, the green grocer, posted a note on grocery shelves explaining why the Kashi brand would no longer be stocked. It went viral and became a springboard for a national debate. Kashi argues the company did nothing wrong because the FDA does not regulate the term natural. As a result of the uproar, Kashi released a statement this week saying beginning in 2015, all new Kashi foods will contain at least 70% organic ingredients and be non-GMO project verified as well. The company's biggest sellers, Go Lean cereals and Chewy granola bars, will be non-GMO project verified by the end of 2014. Read more about these stories and many more on our social media platforms. That's where you can hear the first word in all sorts of food news throughout your day. On Twitter and Facebook, search for Earth Eats.
And go to the website to see what our bloggers are talking about. We've got a slideshow of how creative gardeners have reused waste items to grow plants. And there are a bunch of recipes to get your creative juices flowing in the kitchen, like salsa verde and carrot pickles. Check it out at eartheats.org. Mia Partlow, thanks for the news.
My pleasure.
An unlikely coalition of farmers, businesses, and social advocates is pushing for a law in Kansas that would create a state-sanctioned work program benefiting illegal immigrants. Their fiercest opponent? The Kansas politician who wrote Arizona's tough immigration law. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports.
It's a long way from forget-me-not farms to the Kansas State Capitol.
Thank you, members. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 399.
But T.J. Curtis drove the 300 miles because he needs more workers for his family's dairy farm in the far western part of the state. Curtis's family moved their operation to Kansas from New Mexico a few years ago and now wants to hire another 75 people. So he's here to lobby for a bill that sets up a state program that would help him in hiring undocumented workers who could legally stay in Kansas.
We come to Kansas looking for opportunity for growth and expansion and processing facilities in southwest Kansas. And so we came here looking for opportunity. And for that opportunity, we need good, reliable help and workers.
Curtis is not alone. Kansas feedlot farm and dairy companies are so desperate for workers that State Ag Secretary Dale Rodman, a Republican, asked the U.S. Department of Homeland Security for a waiver that would allow companies to hire illegal immigrants. That effort's going nowhere. So a group called the Kansas Business Coalition proposed another option. The coalition's program would connect participating companies with undocumented workers who have been in Kansas at least 5 years and have a clean record, helping them get work authorizations. Essentially, the state steps forward to vouch for an immigrant's application to the federal government to become a legal resident.
The reality is, when a state stands forward and makes the statement, it's a louder statement than an individual or a private group. And it sends the message that Kansas is not interested in deportation policies. We're interested in work policies.
That's Allie Devine, the coalition's leader. She's a former state agriculture secretary and self-described lifelong Republican who worked in the first Bush administration. She and others have fought off Arizona-style bills in the past because she says the Hispanic population in Kansas is much different than that border state.
These are people that we know in small towns. They're not foreigners. They are people that have been our friends. They've been with our children in school. We've known them.
Case in point, Rodolfo Torres. Across town from the state capitol, Torres is attending a tutoring session, helping his 8-year-old daughter Mariela with her math assignment. The two of them are at Amistad y Fe, Fellowship in Faith, a ministry of the Kansas Area United Methodist Church. Torres has been in Topeka for 19 years, has his citizenship, and works at a local food processing plant. He's thought about moving to other states, but he says he stays here because there are so many jobs.
A lot of work in Kansas, more. Talk to the boss and he say, come back tomorrow.
Fighting the coalition is another Republican, Chris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State who helped write the Arizona law. He says it's a political fantasy to think that Republicans will support the coalition's plan.
I think the very fact that it was proposed has made a lot of people, you know, sit up and take notice and say, wow, this is Kansas. They're proposing something like that. We expect this in California, but not in Kansas. And that is certainly surprising that they would even propose it. But I have to believe that the proponents of this bill realize it's dead on arrival. It just is not going to pass the Kansas House.
Kobach also doesn't buy the pleas of the agribusiness leaders who say they are in dire need of workers. That doesn't fly in a state where farming is done in row crops, he says, and harvested by machines.
I hate to answer with the old adage about comparing apples and oranges, but to a certain extent, the crops rotting in the field argument is comparing maybe not apples to oranges, but oranges to soybeans.
As it stands, the bill is pending in committee, and the state GOP faces a tough internal battle over immigration policy in a state where Republicans control both the House and Senate. So dairy farmers like T.J. Curtis will have to continue looking hard for workers to run forget-me-not farms. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
We're celebrating an all-vegan Cinco de Mayo in the kitchen today. Chef Daniel Orr has a lifetime supply of tofu ready to go, and is going to be the star of all three of these recipes. Let's start with our two condiments. First, a sweet pea guacamole.
What I like about the sweet peas is that it's very low in fat. It has a really nice sweet flavor. And I take it, another step by adding the tofu, which adds a nice protein source. So it's very lean, but it has a lot of flavor in it. And it's so simple. All you need is a good blender. And these sweet peas have just been blanched, which means cooked in some boiling salted water until the skins become tender. And then we shock them in ice water going to add a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. Okay, I've got some chopped ginger. I'm going to add some silken tofu, which is the soft tofu. I'm going to add some garlic, and a lot of times you'll see garlic that has this little green sprout coming out of it, and that's the germ of the garlic. It's the plant actually trying to grow. All right, and what you want to do is you want to remove that. And the reason you do that is if people have problem digesting garlic, it's usually this is what they're having trouble with. You just kind of do a rustic cut. It's going to be pureed anyhow. I added a nice handful of mint, which is going to take it to another level of flavor, and some hot sauce. All right, and then basically it's just a matter of pureeing it. Okay, we have a really nice smooth consistency now, and I'm going to add a little fresh cracked pepper. I always use fresh pepper. Place some of our homemade corn tortilla chips. Decorate it with a little fresh mint sprig.
And we've got a tasty vegan guacamole that even the most adamant tofu haters will enjoy.
All right. So we're going to make a tofu sour cream. So what we're done here, we've got a nice high-powered blender, and we're going to put some tofu in it. Now, this is firm tofu that we're adding first, and that's going to give us a little body. And what I've done is, before we did this, I wrapped it in some paper towel and got a lot of the excess moisture out of it. Then we're going to add a second kind of tofu, which is called silken tofu, and then we're going to add the flavorings. And what we've got is a little bit of salt, olive oil. We've got some honey, which is going to kind of bring out that sweet dairy flavor that you think of when you get sour cream. And you could use any of your favorite hot sauces, you know, whether it's Tabasco or your homemade hot sauce. We're going to use some of the vinegar from our pickled peppers that we did. And in the pickled peppers, we have some cinnamon and some ginger and some habaneros and different chilies out of the garden. So just going to put a couple tablespoons of that in. That also is going to give us some of the acidity that you think of when you think of sour cream. And then finally, we're going to add some lemon juice. Okay, and then we just put the blender on until everything's nice and combined. And we're going to stir it down a little bit. And this is a great base for dips, too. So when you're making a red pepper dip, you could use this as the base and throw in some roasted red peppers. You could add some curry to it and make a curry dip. Some wasabi and make a wasabi mayonnaise out of this.
If you're interested in growing sweet peas, plant them in your garden now. If they don't like it especially warm outside, they'll be ready to enjoy in 2 to 2.5 months. I just checked, and none of our recipe bloggers have posted recipes for making your own tofu, but we do know it's possible. If you know how, send us your recipe to eartheats@gmail.com. Now for the main course in our vegan feast, our vegan dream quesadilla, with even more tofu, tomatoes, and basil.
All right, now we've got some diced tomatoes, about equal amount of tofu and tomatoes. Then we're going to add some fresh herbs. I've got some cilantro and some basil. Just going to take off the big stems, but you know, those cilantro stems have a lot of flavor in them. You don't really need to discard them. A lot of people, I think they throw away too much of the basil and the cilantro. You know, all that stuff is good to eat and has a lot of flavor. And again, you know, I'm using basil and cilantro, but if you have fresh fennel or, you know, you like chives or garlic chives, you could use any of those different ingredients in here.
I know I'm excited about eating this because tomatoes and basil and olive oil, some of my favorite flavors that you've worked with in the past on Earth Eats.
Yeah, we did a caprese salad with tofu and tomato and basil. And, you know, the tofu kind of sits in for the mozzarella cheese, and that's kind of what it's doing. In this recipe, it's sitting in for the white Mexican cheese, which has that kind of little bit rubbery kind of texture. Now what we're going to do is just take our tortilla skin. I'm using a large spinach tortilla. Now we're going to press these down really nice, and we're just going to let that crisp on both sides. So everyone might not have a big pizza oven at their house, but if you don't, I mean, that can turn out just as good. But all you need to do is just to brush them with a little bit of olive oil before you put them on your pizza stone or into that Teflon pan, and you'll be good to go. What we're going to do is garnish this with a little bit of that tofu sour cream. Put a little bit of pesto on there, and we'll finish it with just a few pine nuts. And that's all there is to it. We like to serve it with a pizza cutter, so then your friends and family can just cut it into nice little wedges.
See the recipes along with photos for all three dishes on our website. You can also find a really, really tasty avocado guacamole recipe and any number of salsa recipes from our bloggers. Lots to explore on eartheats.org. Coming up, the Bloomington Community Orchard is dependent on pollinators like birds and bees. We find out what a group of volunteers is doing to encourage the critters to call the orchard home. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. New research could change the way beekeepers do business. A report from Indiana University shows genetically diverse honeybee colonies are less prone to succumbing to bacteria and other pathogens. As WFIU's Gretchen Frazee reports, that means those honeybees could live longer lives.
Honeybee keepers around Indiana have been fighting against disease, parasites, and pesticides for decades.
We're getting ready to fill those with bees here for the spring.
Tracy Hunter of Hunter's Honey Farms outside Martinsville sells his honey around the state, mostly at local farmers markets. He says there are many threats to his honeybees and consequently to his business. He's constantly looking for ways to make his hives stronger.
Beekeepers like to take their strong hives, the ones that survive the winter, hopefully have some genetic traits that are going to survive these problems, and you split the hive and let the bees make a new queen, or you can raise a queen yourself.
But despite their best efforts, beekeepers like Hunter almost always lose some of their hives to disease or parasites. They end up replenishing them by buying queens and what are called starter colonies.
We raise somewhere around 2,000 to 3,000 queens a year.
That's David Shenefield. He's the president of the Indiana Beekeepers Association and one of the main bee vendors in the state. Here's how the sale of bees works. Vendors take a queen and mate it with male drones they get from other sources.
And then also there's other breeders that artificial inseminate queens with different hygienic genetics and mite-resistant genetics. And we throw all those into our gene pool and we work with different ones to keep us from having inbreeding.
Then they take the queen, put her in a hive, and after a few other bees are born, they sell the starter colony to beekeepers. That's where some new research from Indiana University and Wellesley College comes in. One of the head researchers, Irene Newton, says they found the more males the queen mates with, the more diverse a colony is. And that, in turn, made the colony more likely to withstand bacteria and other pathogens.
The bacteria that were in genetically diverse colonies were more likely to be beneficial. So we found a higher number of bacteria affiliated with probiotic genera, like Bifidobacterium and Lactobacilli. We found a decrease in known bee pathogens like Melissococcus and Paedobacillus, which are known to cause foul brood.
Newton says beekeepers have known for a while that more diverse colonies are generally healthier, but her research points to a specific reason, the good probiotic bacteria the colony produces.
And so if we can figure out what's the natural state of the microbiota associated with the honeybee and how to promote that natural state, then maybe we can help the honeybee protect itself from pathogens and from syndromes like colony collapse disorder.
At an orchard about 30 minutes away from his honey farm, Hunter's bees are busy pollinating apple trees. Hunter leases his bees to fruit growers around the state, and he says bees pollinate one-third of all food, so keeping those bees healthy is key.
Pollination is the most important thing that bees do for people. We all enjoy the honey, but pollination is so vital to our agriculture today. In fact, the honeybee is responsible for 80% of the insect pollination.
And while he normally doesn't think about the genetics of his bees, Hunter says he does use the general principles of the study.
I'm not so much concerned what the genetic makeup of the bee is, whether it is a purebred, whether it's a crossbreed. If it is surviving, then that is my number one goal.
And based on the study results, those that have better genetic makeup are more likely to survive. For WFIU News, I'm Gretchen Frazee.
Diversity is also important for orchards, and orchards would not exist without pollinators like honeybees. Amy Countryman is on the board of directors for the Bloomington Community Orchard.
In order for an apple tree to actually make apples, we need some kind of pollinator, whether it be a bee or a wasp or some kind of insect, to actually travel from the blossoms of one kind of apple tree to another kind of apple tree. And they have to be different, which is interesting. You can't use the same kind of apple tree to pollinate another of the same kind of apple tree. So diversity is inherently built into an orchard.
We stopped by a volunteer work day for the Bloomington Community Orchard, where folks are doing the hard work of attracting pollinators now, before the blossoms are fully in bloom. Community members of all ages are wielding drills, saws, and paintbrushes to assemble honeybee hives, mason bee homes, and birdhouses, which will all be installed at the orchard this spring.
We are building, what do you know what these are called? I don't even know what they're, just inserts for the beehives.
Inserts for the hives. Sorry, the honeycombs go in the middle of these frames, and they go in slats in the boxes that those people are making. Mm-hmm. Like a filing cabinet, sort of.
The orchard purchased a starter colony of honeybees called a Nook from Hunter's Honey Farm. Mason bees are a little different, explains Countryman. They're not purchasing any mason bees. They're hoping they just come.
We've got, you know, we're trying to create out there an ecosystem that is really complete, that has everything that birds and bees and people would want, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I think having a food source and water and a shelter is like, I mean, that's what makes me want to go places. So,
unlike honeybees, mason bees are solitary creatures. Each female makes her own nest. There are no worker bees. They don't produce any honey, and they only sting if they're really threatened. They're considered better pollinators than honeybees, but their lifespan is much shorter, only between 4 and 8 weeks. Today, volunteers are making 12 mason bee homes that will probably house some 30 bees each.
You know what I'm thinking? This drill is going to be more powerful than that one. Let's use that one for the little holes. We are building mason bee homes. I also just learned this as well. But what they like is basically a small hole. In their natural environment, they would breed in like a hole made by a woodpecker. But we can make a really similar hole with a drill. And so we're taking blocks of 4x4s and drilling lots of little holes into them.
What I heard is if you drill it too shallow, they will produce more males. And if you don't make it wide enough, then they produce more males as well. And they need more room, apparently, to produce females. And then after that, we line the holes with parchment paper to protect the inside. After that, we put a little roof on it, and hopefully we paint it, you know, like pink.
So we are taking these gourds and cutting holes at them for birdhouses. And depending on the size of the hole, says what kind of bird can live in it. Like, this is 1.5 inches, so this book says it could be bluebirds. I think that's the goal for this one, is bluebirds. One that has, like, a, for instance, like a 1.25 inch would be like a house wren or a chickadee.
Birds, depending upon the kind of bird you attract, they can either be beneficial or not so beneficial to the orchard, because some of them like to eat fruit, but other ones like to eat insects, like bluebird.
Yeah, and then we'll cut out the hole, pull out the seeds, whatever we can reach inside, and then they'll paint it, put it on a hanger, and hang it up for birds. Yeah, it's a lot harder than I expected, actually.
So what we're hoping to do today is to build birdhouses that will attract the insect-eating bugs to try to, you know, support the orchard being a place where we don't use pesticides and create a healthy ecosystem.
Keeping chemicals out of the orchard is important not only for the quality of the fruit, but for the health of the pollinators. A number of studies have linked a certain class of pesticides with colony collapse disorder, which is threatening honeybee populations all over the Midwest. With volunteers of all ages getting their hands dirty in support of the orchard, Amy Roche, facilitator of the board of directors for the community orchard and co-leader of the education team, believes this could be a powerful tool for educating the community about a sustainable food system.
Man, it's so life-affirming. And you know, I think that our hearts are yearning to make a dent in the disparity of distribution of resources. And something that's so, like, iconically, aesthetically pleasing as an orchard, as a way to make that dent, it's just, it's very accessible and draws people together. It's fruit, my God. How could you, you know, not be drawn to fruit?
Amy Roche and Amy Countryman serve in leadership positions for the Bloomington Community Orchard. Learn more about how to get involved with the orchard, see photos of the volunteer workday, and if you've never seen a picture of an orchard mason bee, we've got one of those on the website as well, eartheats.org. Back to the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr for one last quickie recipe. He used some juice from his pickled peppers in the tofu sour cream, and it really wouldn't be fair to not give you an idea how to make that as well, because it really does add so much to that recipe. And hey, you know it's never too early to start thinking about preserving the harvest from your garden.
And one of the ways that you can preserve the season is with some hot chilies. Today what we've done is we've got some habaneros as well as some banana peppers and some Tabasco peppers, and we're going to pickle them. And what you do is you just take some plain old white vinegar, distilled white vinegar. I'm going to add about a quarter of a cup of sugar, and that's going to tame that vinegar a little bit so it won't be quite so astringent. And then we're going to add just a little bit of salt. And again, all of these ingredients are natural preservatives. The vinegar is a preservative, the salt's a preservative, sugar is a preservative. We're just going to bring that to a boil, and I'm going to add some spices. I've got some cinnamon sticks. I've got three star anise. I'm going to stuff these peppers into a nice ball jar. And I leave the habaneros whole, because if I was to cut them or pierce them, a lot more of the heat would come out. Then it's just going to make everything extremely hot, which is good for some people. I've got a couple slices of ginger I'm going to cram into that jar with the chilies. A few garlic cloves. Now my vinegar is boiling. And I'm going to ladle that onto those chili peppers. Being careful that I get those cinnamon sticks and star anise pieces in there too, because they're going to continue to give off flavor as it sits and marinates. Let it cool down to room temperature, and then you can store these in the refrigerator. They'll last 6 to 8 months.
These peppers are beautiful to look at, very colorful. See photos on the website, where you can also see recipes for preserving carrots, asparagus, beans, corn, tons of stuff. eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
Next week, we stick with the vegan theme and speak with the founder of Farm Sanctuary, Gene Bauer, who has been called the conscience of the food movement. Also, can you really call it a weed if it's edible? We test that in the kitchen with a dish for dandelion greens with local sausage. Be sure to come back for that. This has been Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for listening.